Where are we? Circulation chapter.
We're doing so well.
You can sit up closer. You can't hear back.
It's fine. I'm fine.
I turned off that thing in the back so at least you can hear better.
If you want to scoot up, you can scoot up.
Oh, I should hear.
Okay. And I'm recording that Go360 as well as podcast. So people that aren't here can hear it.
Wait, okay. So Wednesday really isn't stopping today?
Wait.
You went tomorrow.
Only in the Wednesday lab.
No, the Wednesday lab, no.
Tomorrow.
It's the same stuff. But tomorrow we do have lecture. We do have lecture tomorrow, right?
Yeah.
Try to review some stuff too, but some new things too tomorrow. EKG, just gotta, you know, can't let you have a break. Remember what we refer to as gas? Remember, what does gas mean as a review? GAS, instead of like gas in your GI tract, probably is. What's the other gas?
Anxiety.
Something like general syndrome. What was that related to? What's the last phase of it? Do you remember the last phase?
Exhaustion
phase. That's where we need to be. That's where you are constantly, right? We're in this exhaustion phase. Do you remember what's going on in the exhaustion phase as a review?
After the fighting the stimulus, you're tired.
You're tired. What else is happening? You're just like, what's your glucose levels? What's your glycogen content like?
Low.
Probably depleted.
Right. That's probably where you all are. Okay.
So, think about that.
So you want to review all the time, right? Just pull things together all the time. So what are we going to do today? We're going to try to wrap up the cardiovascular system. And that way tomorrow we can kind of pull some more stuff together, a little bit new things, and maybe work on some other aspects, and try to integrate some of this content together too to help you out for Thursday. But let's finish up the cardiovascular chapter and some of the main points. So we left off with this. Remember, does this remind you of something, right? The action potential. And of what cell is this type of? This is where it gets confusing. Cardiac cell, but what type of cardiac cell?
Pacemaker.
Is this a pacemaker?
No. Thinking about it.
Yes. Okay. Yes, she was. This is, and this is why I bring this up. This is where it gets confusing. And even on MCAT type of questions, we have students come back and say, thank you, Cooper, because you actually made a point about this, because I would have missed this on my test. And I don't know if they still do this, but I think there's some general questions on here. And some of the Kaplan material that was actually where we had students actually BTAs in Kaplan and tutoring for Kaplan, even the second year medical students was doing that through their first year and second year. We had that in the first time. But they were like, memorized everything. So there's some people that can do that with everything. But this was confusing, even on Kaplan books in some of them. They would say this was the action potential in what type of cell? Well, it depends, right? It's in the heart, but it depends what cell in the heart. This is your ventricular skeletal muscle, not the ASA node, not the AV node, not the atrial muscle. This is your ventricular muscle. And this is where it gets a little confusing sometimes. So, on standardized exams, what they usually ask is, what's the current, or what's the, why do we have that plateau potential? What makes up that plateau potential up at the top? And it's usually the answer to circle would be the calcium. The calcium is influxing into the cell, and it maintains a depolarized state, right? Because calcium into it, it's going to depolarize. So that's that plateau potential. Also, look at the time scale here. 250 milliseconds. That's what we emphasized in lecture. In case some of you missed it. It's a very long time scale, right? Versus an action potential in the neuron, which is about a millisecond, right? Or 2 milliseconds. But remember, at the nerve terminal, what happens at the nerve terminal, motor nerve terminal, for example? Do we know the shape reaction potential in the mantle? No one's run the $100 yet. Okay, that's right. But probably it's a little bit longer than the action potential going down the nerve, because why? You have multiplicated calcium channels in the nerve terminal that also needs to release transmitters. But it's not going to be 250 milliseconds long, right? Why is it so long in the ventricular skeleton and the ventricular cardiac muscle? What is the ventricle going to do? Contract for a long period of time to get blood out, right? In the pulmonary artery and the aorta. So it needs a long, strong contraction. So that's what's happening here. And it's the normal type of action, you know, rise of the action potential that we talked about before, right? Depolarization, open up voltage-gated sodium channels, boom, then open up voltage-gated calcium channels, and those calcium channels stay open for a long period of time. Calcium dumps in and causes what? Calcium goes into the cell, what does it do? In a ventricular cardiac muscle, what does calcium do in the skeleton? It's just the same idea. What does it do? Drives to troponin what? T, I, or C? C for calcium, right? Drives to troponin C. What happens with troponin C? Finds calcium. It does what? Conformational change. Conformational change. It exposes. Active binding site for myosin to bind to. And then you get the contraction, right? So the whole idea. So the more calcium stays in, you can keep those active sites exposed. Myosin binds ratchet. What's going to make the myosin head come back? It's ATP to come off and then back, and then it's ready to bind again. As long as calcium's still around, you've still got the active sites exposed. Boom, keep ratcheting, keep contracting, get that blood out. Boom, right? So this is why you have a long action potential in the ventricular skeleton. Now, they made an emphasis in this figure here, ordinary voltage-gated channels, right? Potassium, ordinary kind of voltage-gated sodium channels. Why is that so important? Let's go back. Let's go back to the pacemaker potentials. This is why we're making a point about it. The pacemaker potential is different. So when you talk about the plateau potential or that cardiac electrical potential, it depends which cell you're in. Why is it so confusing sometimes? Because remember, they don't have a resting membrane potential. They're pacing all the time, right? So they don't really have a resting membrane potential. So it's pacing all the time. But at the low potential, this is what's odd. At the low potential, what's the major ion that's flowing through? That's going to start the depolarization.
Sodium.
That's kind of weird because it's very low. You didn't open up the voltage-gated sodium channels. That's why they call it funny. Remember, it's called funny because it doesn't behave normally. So these negative potential opens up the funny channel. So sodium's going to rush in. So the rise of the pacemaker potential, the initial rise, this is pretty steep here, the initial rise is due to the voltage-gated, the funny channel. It is voltage-gated because it's a low potential opens it, and it's the funny because it's not normal the way it works like an action potential in nerve. And so that causes that depolarization. When you depolarize, there are other types of channels, just like we've talked about at the nerve terminal, right? Other types of channels are voltage-gated calcium channels. They're going to sense that depolarization, and bam, they open. This is T for transitory. It means it's just a transitory calcium channel. So it opens, and it allows an influx in, and what's that going to do? That's going to depolarize the cell more. But it's transient. It only works for a short period of time. It opens up another type of calcium channel called a long-term calcium channel, or an L-type calcium channel. It's a long duration, long-lasting. Do I want you to know every little detail about that? No, but you could get this on standardized exams. What I want you to know is about this initial depolarization is due to a funny type of sodium channel. So that can appear on standardized exams sometimes, that general depolarization is due to the initial depolarization in the pacemaker potential is due to sodium current. And then we start to open up calcium channels. And then calcium opens, and then what's just like a normal action potential? What opens when you start to really depolarize? What brings the potential back down?
Potassium.
Right? So there you go. There's a potassium opening. And then the calcium channel starts close. That's kind of interesting. And then that potassium allows it to come back down. But as soon as you come back down to a low level, guess what you've activated again? The funny sodium channel. So then it starts all over again. Okay, so that's the things to keep straight. that can be confusing every year or confuse people on standardized exams. So hopefully you can kind of go through that. What was the other aspect that we talked about with like calcium regulation inside the cell of how that could have a feedback system for calcium and depolarization? Another aspect that we should kind of put together is at rest. Just think of a cell at rest first. What's leaking inside the cell? From the ranitidine receptor, right? Kind of through the support. The ranitidine receptor leaks a little bit of calcium into the cytoplasm, right? That leaking of calcium into the cytoplasm does what inside the cell? Well, it wants to get the calcium out. So you have an exchanger, sodium-calcium exchanger. So calcium goes out, sodium goes in. That causes depolarization of the cell. What that can do is to open up calcium channels. That calcium comes into the cells through these voltage-gated calcium channels. That calcium can actually cause more calcium to be released. So that's what's called calcium-induced calcium release, or CIRCA. Right, CIRCA. And that CIRCA, that calcium-induced calcium release, comes from the ER. So now we get a lot of calcium. But what's interesting in the cell, if the calcium rises too high, it's a negative feedback on the ranitidine receptor. So you have to visualize this, right? Visualize this craziness of a cell, an ER, like we said, some calcium leaking out. Hopefully you can see this over there. Some calcium leaking out. That then stimulates the calcium-sodium exchanger. Remember, this just exchanger doesn't need ATP, NCX. And then that can cause depolarization. That can cause calcium to come in through a voltage-gated calcium channel. This calcium triggers the calcium to be released from the ER. So this is called calcium-induced calcium release, CIRCA. That then raises even more calcium to come out. Right? And that then can feed back on the ranitidine receptors and inhibit the ranitidine receptor. It's a negative feedback process. So it blocks the ranitidine receptor from being leaky. But what's going to happen in the meantime then? Well, we have calcium pumps to pump calcium out. We have this exchanger working. But if this ranitidine receptor is inhibited, there's no leak. So calcium finally drops. When calcium finally drops, we've taken away the negative inhibition, and calcium can start leaking again. So you kind of get the idea. I just want you to be aware this is what is in models as well.
So it's about the high level of calcium that's more than the feedback.
Yes, yes. This high level of calcium, the ranitidine receptor can be stimulated with a low level of calcium, but if it gets too high, it actually inhibits the ranitidine receptor. All right. So it's when it's really high, and then it will feed back and inhibit this process.
Is that initial influx of calcium?
From the voltage-gated calcium.
That's opening the ranitidine receptor, right?
This one is a voltage-gated calcium
right.
channel.
Right, yeah.
Yes, this is inducing,
that.
Yeah, more of it to be released. That's that low level of calcium that then causes a higher level, and then it comes a negative feedback process. This is this initial little bit of calcium that's coming out here. This is always working, the NCX, to get calcium out and sodium in, but it can actually have more sodium to come in and causes more depolarization of the cell. I just want you to be aware of that kind of model. Now, take a deep breath, because I'm not going to test you on all those little details like that, right? But I want you to understand that the CIRCA, and I did that on old exams where we spent a lot of time in class and we did drawings on the boards and all that stuff. So, but I want you to just hear about that so you're not like, oh, I never heard of CIRCA in a physiology class, you know, cardio. But so this is another model with this. But the general idea is what I want you to get out of is I think it's more generalized approach. Okay? It's a little bit easier to digest, I think, and understand. But there are people who spend their whole lifetime doing nothing but this work right here, still try to understand how the potentials work in pacemaker potentials, right? And then the heart. And there's people, like I mentioned, are doing models, computational models with that. And there are drugs that block the calcium uptake in this and trying to work on cardiovascular disorders, right? Because number one killer in America and the worldwide is of adults is cardiovascular disorders, right?
So the sodium potassium exchangers on the plasma plasma membrane.
The sodium.
Yes,
it's on the plasma membrane.
Okay. So I just want you to, you know, generally get the idea of these different potentials. And where they take place is important, like that plateau potential, that long plateau potential is in the ventricle. There's a little bit in the atrial muscle as well, because what do the atria have to do? They have to contract too to push blood in, but not as long as the ventricle muscle. So kind of go through that idea of understanding this, and what we just mentioned, the long refractory period too, right? That these sodium channels can remain inactive for a long time. It's basically because it's not hyperpolar, it's not a low potential, and that's what opened them to begin with. They call it a refractory period channel. It's not like the same that we talked about with neurons. So, we depolarize the ventricles. What are they supposed to do? They're supposed to pump out the blood, right? So there's some delay, and we went through that delay. What is all that delay? It's the calcium coming in, binding through component C, binding up, exposing the active site, active myosin, all that stuff that we just went through, right? So that's important to then cause, here you go, there's chairs up here too, if you want to, whatever you want to do. So there's a delay to then the contraction phase of the ventricle. All right? Okay, so the EKG, we're going to go through some of that tomorrow too in class. Do remember, we do have class. Okay. So the EKG, phenomenal. You covered this already. You did the EKG, right? It's a lab. But some points that might be a little confusing with the EKG. So, you know, if you look at these waves, you should know what these waves are. What's the P wave related to? Atrial depolarization, right? QRS? Ventricular T wave? Ventricular repolarization? Where's the atrial repolarization? Inside the QRS? Kind of a misconception sometimes. Because if you have a, and I know it's always in textbooks, but if you have an arrhythmia, let's say you have a block and you have P wave, QRS, do you see the repolarization of the atrium? No, not really. The general textbooks generally say they're buried in the QRS, but if you have a blockage and you have P wave, QRS, well, you didn't have a ventricular contraction, but you don't see a repolarization of the atrium in that wave generally. So it's kind of confusing sometimes. But a lot of textbooks actually tell you it's buried in the QRS. You can go with that. It's still use that on standardized exams because that's what they want as an answer. All right? I know it's a little issue. There are great jobs out there if you're interested in doing EKG reading. They work in the hospital. They read the EKGs in the ICU, for example, or on the floor. And you stay there as an EKG reader, and you keep reading, and it's on the monitors, right, if anybody's in the hospital floor. It's pretty cool because, you know, it's a job. It's healthcare. And you're, you know, waiting for someone to have a STEMI or some kind of problem after surgery, and they, you know, hey, they need something. And everybody's tired of hearing beep, 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 beep all the time. No one pays attention to it. They're immune to that response. They habituated to it. So somebody's actually watching to make sure there's changes. And so you kind of watch for things. It's really kind of cool. But there's more to this than meets the eye. All right, and we're going to go over some of this tomorrow, just a little more in depth. But what is happening from P wave, the beginning of the P wave, to the beginning of the QRS?
It's going from the atria to the ventricles.
Okay, so SA node, and like you said, the atria contracting, electrical activity going through there, and going to the SA node, or going to what? Going to what causes the QRS? You said it earlier. The depolarization of the ventricles. So what did you go through here? You went through the AV node. Already past the AV node, right? And now this is where you get messed up on standardized exams, right here. This is a key point. Because this also includes the AV node, right? This includes the AV node. This includes the delay in the AV node. What speeds up heart rate with the sympathetic innervation to the heart? Speeds up time in the AV node. It speeds up the conduction in the AV node. Remember, normally the AV node slows down the electrical event. So if you have sympathetic innervation, it actually speeds it up. So what would happen with your P to Q time? Shorter, right? So these are the kind of things you really want to, you know, kind of think about the whole picture. And sometimes drawing it out will really be helpful because it is easy to kind of think it might be to the AV node. That's a question that you got to watch out for. And then the QRS, and remember, people always ask that. The Q, sometimes it depends on which lead you record, right? You might see a Q, you might not. You might see an S, you might not. But they still call it a QRS complex because it depends on which lead you're recording from. And then there's some more to this than what meets the eye. So, PR segment. Through the AV node, it also represents this delay. The segments and intervals, I know it's confusing. You would think they would have made this easier, but they don't. The ST segment represents this plateau phase, too, so you know, think about this. And this ST is really quite interesting. We'll talk more about it tomorrow, because this can actually indicate if you had a myocardial infarction or maybe a traumatic brain injury, depending on the shape of this ST segment. It's really quite neat. And then the TP is this passive filling of the ventricles. Okay, so there are other waves that you might not have had in the textbooks that you're reading, particularly like the U wave. And not all traces record the U wave, but it's kind of an interesting wave as well. So these intervals and segments, I know it's a lot to remember, and you would think it would be a straightforward. If you think of before the QRS, it includes the P, so P, R interval. The interval includes the wave that we're talking about versus the segment between those. So think about before the QRS, it includes the P to the R. After the QRS, the ST interval doesn't include the wave before the S. It includes the last part. So think of before and the end. I know, but these are ways to try to remember it. So it includes the T up to the S. Okay? You understand where it's confusing, but maybe the ways you can confuse. And then in the middle, it actually has it pretty well done. It has the QRS interval, which includes the whole darn thing. Right? So to the left, to the whole thing, to the right side only. Okay? Ways to remember the interval so you won't forget it. You can always remember that. And then the segments are just up to it. And we'll talk about these segments, which are really quite interesting, tomorrow. Okay, don't try to memorize these numbers. I don't want you to memorize numbers, but I want you to understand the general concepts, what's going on, right? What's happening where? And I think that will really help you later on. And the reason is some of these appear on standardized exams, too. If you're taking those, then you'll blow this away. It's really quite neat. But the general points, and you had a lab generally on this, too. And we should understand which the sympathetic system would do for you. Okay, sounds are really cool too if you put them in together with the EKG. What do the sounds represent? Love the jaws, right? Sounds? The vowels. Which vowels? Sounds like a love. What's happening? Atrial contract. This is atrial contraction. They push blood into the ventricles. Ventricles contract, high pressure, right? What are they going to close first? Ventricles contract, blood pushes back against the AV valves, right? Low. The ventricles are still contracting. They're finally opening up the pulmonary artery aorta valve. Blood's going over there, but now the ventricles relax. Blood comes back. Dub. Love. Dub. Right? Love. Dub. If you remember that, do that, then you kind of remember, oh, atrial valve's closed. Then the aortic and pulmonary valves close. And they're closing together, that's why it's loved up. But if you heard, like, loved up, then you kind of want to go, wrong, right? Or loved up swish, right? What is that? Loved up swish. Loved up swish. Well, what did the loved up mean? What did the dub mean? Closing of these valves. But if they don't close, right, then you get the swish. If you get love swish dub, what is that related to, Jen? Is these closing, but maybe they didn't close, maybe they're insufficient, maybe they, you know, went into the atrium, right? Maybe the porta tendae are damaged and you're getting the backflow into the atrium. So as long as you can visualize these things, I think you'd really get it down. So it's different than just studying and memorizing. You have to visualize things. You've got to draw it out. It really helps with understanding. And then these other sounds, which I won't test you on, but these are really quite interesting, S3 and S4, because you hear them at different times, and sometimes early in development, our athletes have these other sounds, and it's like atrial filling. You know, the atria are going to fill, right?
you know, fluid just flowing in passively, and you can sometimes hear these sounds. Infants have these sounds, but then at certain stages you just lose them. Athletes sometimes have them. Doesn't mean anything bad. It just happens in there. So these two main ones we want you to know is S1 and S2, these love doves and what they refer to. On your PowerPoints that you might have downloaded, I think this was scrunched off your PowerPoint, so you have to, you know, might move that up on the PowerPoint. But so that might have been hidden down there. Didn't mean to do it, just the way it came out. But hey, Kentucky's known for something. Look at that. Kentucky. It's actually known in textbooks. You get Kentucky known for this. And it's actually the sound. Kentucky, these three sounds. It's when you hear sound three. And sometimes they hear sound four in really strong athletes. So they might hear sound four and they actually call that Tennessee. So hey, Kentucky and Tennessee, the books for cardiology around the world, actually. So Tennessee, because you can hear all four sounds in the Tennessee the way you syllabus. So I'm not going to touch on these two, but generally it's kind of interesting if you ever hear those before, because a lot of times you don't cover sounds three and four in classes or hear about them. But it's kind of neat. Okay. So when we talk about action potentials in the heart, this is why it's important to know what cell you're talking about and where in the heart, because they have different shapes. We've talked about the top one and the bottom one mostly, right? We talked about the SA node and the pacemaker potential. And we talked about this ventricular muscle fiber here, kind of two extremes. Well, this ventricular muscle fiber, kind of the same way for the atrium, because what do you have to do with the atrium? You have to contract the atrium to fill up the ventricles, right? So you want to pretty good contraction there too. So, you know, a little bit prolonged there, a little bit of a plateau, but not as much as these ventricular muscles for contraction. And the time scale quite long for ventricular contraction. EKGs are amazing because they tell you so much about your heart, and not just your heart, ionic balance as well, and other problems. And we'll talk more about that tomorrow a little bit, which is really quite cool. And, you know, some of the first ones, if you hit that Wikipedia, I think it was a dog named Boxer or something like that, or Baxter, where they first recorded EKGs in Germany. And, oh, that reminds me. It was the first grad student that actually asked this question one time, and their teacher got upset. So why do we have EKGs and ECGs? It's the same, right? I don't want you to leave this class without knowing that. Cardio, German, K, cardio, English, C. Okay? Alright, so that's that question.
That's good, please.
Those questions on older gen. I want you to know generally that these shapes, you know, what these report, like, well, no, just the main idea. And that the point, I think, on another test question, it showed the question might have been open response question. Why is there a delay from that line? If we drew the line down from the SA node, it would come down to about here, right? Why is this one so delayed? We know that now, right? Conduction down takes time, right? Where's the big delay coming from? AV note, right. And you can speed that up by getting sympathetic innervation. That might be much more. Yeah. Okay, so, good question. So, you know, you can record EKG and all kinds of things, ECG. You can record them in crayfish, wonderful little creatures. But they're different potentials, basically, we're just for recording electrical events. So, you know, all these animals have to have some depolarization of the heart to make them work. Systole, we know, is what? Contracting phase, diastole is the relaxation phase, right? That's the main points to remember. And we'll talk about that. Remember, these are both occurring at the same time in the left and right side of the heart, right? It's not, I remember open response question, and that, you know, how's the heart pacing work? And they said, well, first the right side works, pushes blood over to the left side, and the left side works and pushes up, you know, correct? These are all happening at the same time, right? Blood's moving all the time, right? And the left side puts out, what, more blood than the right side, or less blood than the right side? The same, right? Because you can't have blood building up in your lungs, you're going to get congested lung, heart failure, congested something. Okay, so kind of know these general ideas, right? And we've just talked about this, what these mean. So the real point comes to this figure, and this figure relating with the electrical events in the heart. So let's blow that up.
and we've had this on all past exams generally, really important figure to what? Draw out by hand, basically, and try to know what's going on at these different steps. What are some of the key points here, though? So this is what side? Left, right? Left or right side? It says here, left. Right foot. Now, the right side does the same thing, but lower pressures. Some textbooks show the right side to the left side compared. Just think of the right side the same, but lower pressures. So you can look at this and you can see it says aorta, and you know the pressure in your aorta is going to, you know, go from low to high when it pushes blood in. But let's work through this. And so if you draw this out, which is a good idea to do, let's start with the cycle. You get depolarization of the atrium. Well, what's that going to do? Cause the atrium to contract. So what happens in the atrial pressure? It's going to build up. Right? The atrium is contracting. What's it going to do? It's going to push blood into the ventricle. So what's going to happen with the ventricle? Well, that's going to start to increase in pressure, so ventricular pressure is going to go up. That's this red line right there, right? Okay. So what happens to the volume in the left ventricle? Well, it's passively filling. Then all of a sudden the atrium contracts, so what happens? Boom! You get a lot of volume in the ventricle. But when the ventricle contracts right here, this little darker phase, what's going on right there? And this is where standardized tests come in too. And this phase has a certain name to it. It's called isovolumetric contraction phase. Iso, same, contraction, the ventricle is contracting, right? It's the QRS complex here. It's depolarized and it is contracting, right? But the volume's not changing. Why is the volume not changing? You just close the AV valves, LUB, and the aortic and the pulmonary artery valve haven't opened yet. So the volume can't change, but it's contracting. So what happens to a balloon when you contract on it? The pressure's going to go up. So it's isovolumetric, means the volume doesn't change, but look at the pressure wave in the ventricle. It's gone way up, right? And what happens right here? So you should know these certain points. What's happening like right here? Can you get low pressure to go to a high pressure system? Can you get low pressure, water to go to a high pressure system by itself? No. It always has to go from high to low, right? So how can we get blood from the left ventricle into the aorta? That means the pressure has to be higher in the ventricle to push blood into the aorta. The aorta pressure is not higher than the ventricle while blood's flowing into the aorta. So this part has appeared on standardized exams and people miss it right here because the red line has to be above the blue line to be able to get blood to go into the aorta or into the pulmonary artery. So the ventricular pressure exceeds that of the pulmonary aorta or the pulmonary artery. And right here is when the valve opens. So now the blood's going into the aorta or the pulmonary artery if it's the right side. And the blood's going in, but once the ventricle starts to relax right here, and you see they're equal, pressures are equal, now what happened right here? Dub happened right there. The love dub happened right there. The aortic valve and the pulmonary artery valve have closed, right? And now we're into this relaxation phase of the ventricle, so ventricular pressure drops a lot, and we see that there's no change. This is another isovolumetric point right here, right? Because there's no blood going into the ventricle, the pulmonary artery and the aortic valve are closed, but the AV valves are not open. So there's no volume change. This is another isovolumetric point. And then once this drops below the atrial pressure, now the atrial valves can open and you get this passive, you get this filling in the ventricle. All right. And then what's happening right here at 18? Standardized tests love to ask this question too. If you were able to catheterize somebody up their femoral artery, for example, and get a pressure transducer into their right at the base of their aortic valve, right on that side, you could measure this little pressure wave. It's pretty cool. But right here then, this is called the dicrotic notch.
So it has a name. It's called the dichrotic notch. And sometimes on standardized exams, they give you that name and they want to know what it's due to. This is due to what? The blood going in the aorta or the pulmonary artery. You can't record very well on the pulmonary artery side, right? Because you can't go through the lungs to get to there. And it's hard to go through the right atrium, right ventricle, up to there, and then to keep the valve open, right? So you record from the left side, and that's why they use these figures. This is the back flow. The valve closes, and this is the back pressure that happened. The dub. Love, dub, right? And it causes that little back pressure. I don't know why people love to test you on that stuff, but it's a dichrotic notch, so I don't want you to miss it on some standardized exam. So that's why it's there. Okay? And then here are the sounds that relate to what we've just talked about, right? But they only usually give you those two sounds, love, dub, and not sound 3 or sound 4, which usually sound 3 is due to atrial filling, passive filling, and 4. Okay, so we went through that stuff. Cardiac output, really important to know cardiac output. I haven't made the exam yet. I need to. Probably Wednesday night. And hopefully before Thursday morning. And then the cardiac output, we've had that in old exams, and it does appear on standardized exams to what it relate to and how to measure it. Heart rate times stroke volume. So usually if you're exercising, right, your heart rate goes up. So primarily cardiac output might go up because of the heart rate. If you go too fast, what happens? The stroke volume increase or decrease? If you're going really fast, you can't fill, so stroke volume actually can decrease. But heart rate's so high that you try. But if it gets too high, then stroke volume's dropping too low, and your cardiac output is down, right? So it's all kind of a, you know, mix in there. But the idea is how to measure cardiac output, you know, liters per minute, is heart rate times stroke volume. And cardiac output increases, you know, with exercise or activity levels. And we'll go through a little bit more of that later. Really quite neat. And the regulation, we've talked about some of this before, but just to reemphasize it, right? Heart rate, vagal nerve, 10th cranial nerve, acetylcholine release, but get confused all the time because you think of your skeletal muscle. It's not skeletal muscle. It's not causing contraction. It actually slows down the heart. Works on the SA node, right? Slows it down. Transmitters of acetylcholine, what type of receptors are those? Inotropic. Metabotropic, nicotinic, muscarinic, all of the above, none of the above. Muscarinic on the SA node, right? And it's a metabotropic, works for a second messenger cascade. Standardized test questions. All right, we've got to really get that going. And then the sympathetic system, we just talked about that too, can reduce AV nodal delay, so it speeds up the heart rate, right? It's pretty cool.
Where do the sympathetic neurons innervate?
So the question was, where do the sympathetic neurons innervate? They innervate onto the muscle directly, which is pretty cool, and then like on the AV node too. And what's really neat about the AV nodes, not only does it increase, what are the two words we want to remember? Chronotropic and inotropic. Chrone, rate, like clock, chrone, you know, time. Chronotropic, it can speed up the rate, but inotropic, contraction, strength of contraction. So not only can it speed up the rate, but it can speed up the strength of contraction. So sympathetic, chronotropic, and inotropic, where parasympathetic, primarily chronotropic, slowing it down. All right. So those terms have been used on standardized exams too, and people said, I don't know those, and I said, well, you didn't take 350 with me. So, okay, so anyway. Try to remember these things that you've got it down. All right, and this is the general, you know, what we just talked about. So just kind of putting it in schemes, slowing down or speeding up the rate. Okay, so sympathetic, parasympathetic, heart rate. And something else that's really interesting about regulation of it all. Remember, let's just review for a little bit. What happens when you overstretch the atrium? What hormone is related to that process? If you overstretch the atrium, magical things happen. The atrial secretes a particular hormone. Atria starts with a, yes, starts with an A. So atrium, atrial natriuretic peptide. What does it do?
if you stretch the heart, you want to do what? You want to decrease the stretching. So the way to decrease the stretching is to get rid of the volume, right? So it works in the kidneys to cause diuresis. So now you're going to promote more pee, and you're going to reduce your blood volume, and less stretching will occur. But something else that's very unusual occurs in the ventricles, which is really neat too. If you're exercising, let's say you exercise for a bit, and the ventricle fills up with more blood, and you stretch the ventricle, well, you could, you know, be damaging if you stretch it too much, right? And you keep stretching it, like fill it up too much. But the ventricle has this magical power, which is called the Frank Starling principle, and it increases its contractility. It increases its strength of contraction. This has appeared on standardized exams. What the Frank Starling principle is, if you overfill the ventricle, you contract harder, and you get the blood out. So now it won't fill up and won't stretch more for the next time. So now you'll have all that blood removed, so you can have a normal filling the next time. So it won't have residual blood inside of there. So the Frank Starling law, it's pretty neat. Most all mammals have this, that people have looked at. So it's something interesting about the ventricular muscle that happens. All right, sympathetic
not only can stimulate the heart, but it can actually mobilize blood from your veins. It can actually cause the veins to contract and actually mobilize blood.
Remember, at rest, a lot of your blood is stored in your veins. It's like a reserve pool, right? That's where you're, if you need to mobilize your blood, like if you start to exercise for your skeletal muscle, it's going to come from the veins, which are kind of dispensable and just holding all this blood as a reserve pool.
All right.
Where's my thing? Okay, so this is the kind of stuff that we've just talked about. It's just put in a diagram for you. All right. So we have, we've talked about the coronary artery circulation, right? Right out of the aorta, right past the first valves that come open, you have that little opening that starts the coronary blood flow. What's really neat is the coronary blood flow can have some local regulation. And it's really quite amazing because if you have low oxygen supply, like hypoxia, right, low oxygen, locally, that releases adenosine. And adenosine can actually cause vasodilation to promote more blood flow, to decrease that oxygen depth. So that's pretty neat. So it's kind of a local regulation in the coronary blood flow system. And we know that this is, you know, a major problem, heart attacks, primarily from blockage in the coronary arteries. Alright, so we start getting a little math, and I know math people have math phobias and all that. It's okay. So we should know this equation, but is this a new equation to you? No. What do you remember from the nervous system? Anybody got that tattoo yet for extra credit? 10 points? No, I'm joking. The Ohm's law, right? Ohm's law, I equals V over R. Is this any different than that? No. I, flow, current, equals V, voltage, over R, resistance. So the voltage, the pressure, the voltage difference over R, resistance. It's the same as Ohm's law. I equals V over R, but instead, flow with the delta pressure over R for resistance. It's the same idea. So this is really important because this regulates the flow through the blood vessels, just like what we've talked about with Ohm's law. The point here is that if you're working with a low pressure system like 90 to 10, it's still a change of 80 millimeters of mercury. Isn't that silly, this millimeters of mercury? We don't do that anymore, right? But everything's converted to that, right? Because it's the old days, right? Is everybody familiar with that kind of thing? It's a mercury manometer. It was mercury put into a U-tube, and they could measure atmospheric pressure. And it was basically your blood pressure could be hooked up to the same thing that people use to measure atmospheric pressure, and you could see the mercury go up and down, and what happens on the sphygmometers or the normal little thing that you put on a pressure cuff today, is there mercury in there? No. But I had a person, I won't say who they were, that said, oh, their thing broke and they're worried about mercury coming. There's no mercury in there anymore, all right? There's no mercury in these pressure cuffs or anything like that. They've calibrated it to the old values that are on here. Now, they might see a water manometer nowadays, but those don't really exist anymore either. It's just calibrated. It's all electronically done. Okay, so there's no mercury around these things anymore. But it's still millimeters of mercury. It's calibrated to this because of the original recordings. The point here is that 10 minus 90 is 80. Look at this. 180 minus 100. The pressure difference is the same, right?
It's still 80 millers and meters of mercury. So was the flow any different? No, the resistance is the same. So the flow is the same, but you're working at a much higher absolute pressures. This is the problem, like with plaque buildup. You're working at these higher pressures, but you haven't, you know, the flow can be a problem. And then you're going to blow some blood vessels. So not great. Now we're going to come back to changing R and how that relates here in a minute, too. So really important to kind of understand this equation in a sense. Okay, so, you know, we've talked about pressure gradient, what's that due to, and you relate to, like this giraffe. When you step out of bed, what happens in the morning? You realize, I'm like 350, oh no, I have to hurry. Let's meet it, just look up to bed. Catch that, she's ready. The thing is that you step out of bed, and what happens to you? You might have that little blackout, right, initially, and you just wait and think, I'll get coffee soon enough. And why are you having that blackout? Because your blood pressure dropped, right? And what happens? Your carotid sinuses detect that. And then what happens? They stimulate, they go to your brain. What are they going to activate? Sympathetic nervous system. Then causes increased heart rate. So when you do that, when you stand up, and this is why they do that in the hospital, they'll have somebody lay in bed, just stand up, measure their blood pressure, measure their heart rate, sit down, stand up, measure the heart rate, measure the blood pressure, and they'll do that like 3 times. And they want to know if they're actually having an autonomic response well enough. It checks, are your carotid sinuses working? Because if somebody's always falling or passing out, they want to know if they have the reflex. So it's a standard test that's used. If your grandparents or something is having blackouts, you can do that too. And their heart rate should increase for that short period of time, right? And they usually have a problem. Usually older people are dehydrated, and that's part of the problem too. So understand that that's regulated to the system. Now this equation that used to be in Kaplan exams, I don't know if it still is. Anybody taking Kaplan courses right now? Is it still there? Okay, so it's still there, so you should know this stuff. And the main things to remember here is that this is resistance. So this is the bottom part of this equation. Remember, flow, change of pressure, resistance. So remember, it's on the bottom. So what happens here? If you increase resistance, does that directly increase flow? It's inversely related, right? It's inversely related. But now let's look at what makes up this R. And this R is made up by this equation here. And the two major factors here is this N, if you will, and this R to the fourth power. And again, this is inversely related to resistance. So it's directly related to this appearing sense. So here's pi, and this is, you know, the pi that you're used to, right? Not pi in a circular thing. So 8, viscosity times the length of the vessel divided by this pi, and then the radius, and the radius to the fourth power. This is the key point, because if you change the radius, just double it, it doesn't just reduce the radius by half, it reduces it a lot more than that for the resistance. If you increase viscosity, what's that going to do to resistance, right? You increase the red blood cell count, like erythropoietin with Lance Armstrong. You can increase the resistance, so that's because of increased viscosity. So that's directly proportional, right, to resistance. So let's look at this, for example, in this diagram. So we've increased the radius of this vessel. We've still got 10 mils of blood in here, but look at what's happening here. Because the radius in vessel 2 is 2 times of vessel 1, what happened to the resistance? It's 1/16, because it's to the fourth power of the diameter, the radius of that vessel. So the fourth power, this is the point you want to remember down here, proportional to R to the fourth, and it's the inverse relationship to resistance. Now, what happened on some standardized exams a long time ago, even in this class, some of my old colleagues that used to teach this, they would love to confuse students because they wouldn't just use resistance here. They would put that R and then have you back calculate to flow, for example, right? I'm not trying to be mean in that sense, but you should know generally then that this then is going to influence this, that then influences flow in general, okay? And if we do anything in our test, which I haven't made up yet, I usually, as you've learned, I try to make it where you don't need a calculator. It's standard kind of, you know, thing, so you don't need to stress out. Pardon?
Oh, I would know it for your general,
you know, and what, you know, there's so much, right, this test, as you know, but you can't ask all the questions. So what we don't ask in this test, we'll work for you at the final.
I was going to say, they just want you not to know the formula, just that R has to be factored.
Okay, so it's like in the like fourth house in inverse relationship.
Okay, good. Oh, good classes. If you're really looking for some classes next semester to take, is anybody taking 412G human physiology? It's okay, right? Isn't it good? Yes?
Yeah,
easier than this one, harder than this one? Not considering the lab, because the lab is up here.
It's a lot more in depth.
You think they're going more? Endocrine?
They go way more.
Okay. Yeah. We're just trying to get them in. So, yeah, that course is really good, and it supplements a lot of this. I think the same stuff that you're studying for this is pretty much the same, a lot of it. But if you really want to kick butt, sorry, if you really want to kick something, PGY 502, systems physiology, 5-hour credit course, 6 or 7 different instructors. Sometimes they bring in some clinicians in there to help teach it too. But it's 5 hours to really go in depth in the content. And sometimes if you're applying to UK Med School, those might be on your interview board or people that you might be interviewing with, usually through the physiology department. It's a mixed undergraduate-graduate student mix, but still like 100 kids in there or more. But it's a really good course to take, PGY 502. And more in-depth, usually don't use a textbook, but a lot of PowerPoints, and you're getting a person to talk just in the field that they actually do their research in, so they can kind of tell you and keep you up with the latest information, which is really quite neat. Anyways, 412G is taught every semester and online. I think there's even an online course next fall. In the summer, it's online. The summer courses are kind of expensive, so, you know, take it as easy, but you could speed up things if you want to take it. All right, so the general points there. We should think about how do we circulate things, movement of legs. This blood pressure is important for what? For, like, spiders, that's arachnoids. Some valves for the comparative aspect. We're talking about filtration, you know, to filter blood, sexual aspects here. Also, for some animals, it might actually, like this echina, this animal here, we'll see it here, this thing, this nose comes out based on pressure. Some bivalves use this blood pressure to actually bury into the sand. So kind of neat, and you probably heard about spiders pushing their legs out or jumping because of blood pressure changes that they can have. But we're not going to get too much into this. It's kind of interesting. Okay, and we've talked about fluid compartments before. Remember, extracellular fluid around the cells. Some animals actually separate these extracellular fluid compartments, and they don't mix. But, you know, we don't have to test on anything like this. It's just that you know, kind of get the idea that some of these might not all be mixing together, because in some animals they can be separated. We did talk about myogenic and neurogenic hearts, right? Myogenic means it can beat on its own, like ours. And like some invertebrates, like the larval Drosophila is myogenic. So is some of the adults. It depends on the type of animal, but like your favorite animal, the crayfish and crabs, they are actually neurogenic. They need the neural input every time for that heart to beat. So they're neurogenic. They don't have the type of pacemaker potentials to keep going. Kind of interesting. All right, so we've just talked about this. And here where we get into, remember, insects generally don't use the blood system to transport oxygen. I know we didn't cover respiratory yet. We'll cover that later. But they use the tracheal system, right? So the trachea go right down into the skeletal muscle and deliver oxygen, take away CO2. And the blood can help with nutrients and ion delivery and washing those tissues out, hormone delivery, right? This is pretty cool. They've actually injected a latex dye into the animal. You can actually inject this latex dye into the animal and then let it go to all the little capillary beds and arteries, and then you dissolve the tissue away with nitric acid, and it dissolves the cuticle and muscle, and all you're left is with the circulatory system. pretty neat because look at the point here is look at the gills. The gills are there and they're very heavily, you know, got a really neat circulatory system. And they actually have capillary beds. Remember, people think, you know, you get these kind of questions about invertebrates don't have capillaries. Well, they do, right? And here's capillary beds in the gills, very well vascularized. But here's like the claw, you know, the claw up there. And the blood vessels go down the muscle, but those have open endings. So they just open up and blood just pumps out and it comes back around the claw, back into the heart, and into the heart has those holes in it, ossi, that then can take the blood in and then perfuse it out. Okay, so pretty neat. We could spend the whole time on this. Just do ah. Okay, great. Okay, so, but we should know the differences of some of these animals as we work through. This is compared to physiology. Fish, atrium and ventricles, right? Atrium pumps the blood into the ventricle, then out to the systemic, and just like in us, what does this atrium do? Prime the ventricle, prime the big heart, prime the major pump of the animal to go against that big resistance out in the systemic circulation. Amphibians, when we get to frogs, three chambers. The ventricle is really quite neat in the three-chambered animals because it can kind of shift that little septum around inside of the ventricle in amphibians. So we're beginning to get to the four-chambered heart as we build up from amphibians into reptiles. So it's kind of neat. I don't want you to memorize the differences in flow things here, but you see this kind of septum that's open here, and it can move back and forth a little bit depending on its needs, but kind of neat. In amphibians, where are they getting their oxygenation from? A lot of the amphibians. Through the skin, right? So they have a lot of circulation through the skin, so they don't need kind of this thing to go through a gill chamber or a lung system. In many cases, they're getting it through their skin, so they've got good flow. But what you see throughout the animal kingdom is usually circulation goes first from the pump to what? To the respiratory structure, either skin or like in the fish, gills. Even in the crayfish, the first big blood vessel out of that heart was to the gills. So it's pretty neat. Get oxygenation first, right? And then get it into the body and circulate it, because that's the necessary point. So that's the main point here. This is really quite neat. Some textbooks, depending on which one you might be looking at, or others, they separate out. Don't try to memorize the differences. On some old exams, I think, some really old ones that might not even be on the test bank, some instructor made a big point about the African lungfish versus the Australian lungfish. There are some differences among the two, but the general point here is what? It's really quite amazing. They have lungs and gills. And there's lots of stories about these animals and the people in like Central Africa, where these things live, is that in the rainy season, the flooded pond, right? So the fish are swimming around. But when the water goes away, what do these do? They wiggle down into the mud and make this mucus thing around them. And then they don't need their gills. They're using their lungs. And they can breathe through their lungs. So when the farmers say, okay, the rainy season's over, we can plant our crop now in this nice rich soil. So they dig in the ground and all of a sudden the fish come out. You get the idea, it probably started a lot of folklore and a lot of things that created. So some people have these ideas of life created through the fish from the ground because of this kind of lungfish. But it's really quite neat because we see the circulation going through the lungs as well as the gills, and they can bypass that and use their lungs. So it's kind of a neat thing. And so people use those as study models and kind of interesting. And there's differences in African and Australian lungfish. So the main thing to remember, too, as we go through the reptiles and we have this three-chambered heart, when we get to the crocodiles, and there's some differences on different types of crocodiles, but the crocodile, the standard kind of test question is, this is the first animal on the evolutionary scale that you actually see the four-chambered heart. But the crocodile still has something very unusual. It has this foramen of Panizzi, if I pronounce. Anybody Italian? How do you pronounce it? Panizzi? I always ask. No one's like come up and told me exactly how to pronounce it. Panizzi, I guess. Okay, we'll call it that. I think of a pizza. But anyway. So this is quite interesting because this, if you think of crocodiles, they're diving animals, and they can stay underwater a long time. That's why they can, like, remember that crazy thing about the Disney kid that drowned? The crocodiles can hold somebody underwater and drown them because they can stay underwater a long time, longer than you can. So that's the problem.
And so the main thing to remember with them is they have this very unusual ability to shunt blood away from their lungs. And the thing that's interesting about them, so think of your ventricles. You have these two ventricles. What happens? Pulmonary artery to your lungs, the left side to your aorta. But these crocodiles, they have two outgoing valves, two outgoing vessels on their right side. They have not only the pulmonary artery, but they have what's called the left aorta. So they can actually shoot off into the aorta. But the left aorta can actually branch over to the aorta off their left side. So this one can attach to this one. And blood can then go this way and bypass the lungs where they don't need it when they're diving for a long period of time. It's just something very unusual. But we're going to see something very similar in humans, all right, as we come along. So it's quite interesting to think about. So that's the main point about this, is that they allows them to shunt blood away from where they don't need it for their long time. Now, there's still some blood going through there because they can get pick up some oxygen from holding their breath for a time. Okay, so we don't want to get too crazy about that. But in birds and mammals, four-chambered hearts, the fetus is really an interesting aspect. And we're going to talk about two main things in fetal development of the heart: the foramen ovale and the ductus arteriosus. Anybody ever hear about a blue baby? Yeah, a blue baby being born? No? It's not royalty, right? It's not blue blood. But the blue baby is not getting oxygen, right? And so the face is blue, the lips are blue, not oxygen, pee, something's wrong. Why is that? A lot of cases it could be foramen ovale or ductus arteriosus. And the foramen ovale is really quite amazing. This is this process, it's just like the diving crocodile. If your fetus developing, is your lung getting oxygenation from the, is your body getting oxygenation from the lungs? No, right?
Where is it getting its oxygen from? Oxygen's from? Fetal blood comes from? The oxygenation's from the placenta, right? So the mother's placenta is really important. So, okay, so the placenta is getting oxygenation. So it doesn't need to really have a good vascularization to the lungs. And really, the lungs develops later than the heart, right? The heart's one of the early organs that's developing the fetus, right? That's where you hear the heart rate beat. Okay, so let's bypass the lungs. How can we bypass the lungs? Well, in the two atria you have, let's put a little hole between the two. We can get blood going from the right atrium over to the left atrium. Pretty neat. That's the foramen ovale. All right. But if we do go out the pulmonary artery in the aorta, do we really need blood going to the lungs? Well, we need something to keep the nutrition going and stuff like that, right? But let's go and bypass it. So let's go from the pulmonary artery over to the aorta, and that's the ductus arteriosus. But when you're born, what do you need? You don't have your placenta anymore. So you need oxygenation from your lungs. So what do you hope that closes? You hope this closes, and you hope that closes, right? So blue babies, sometimes this stays open, or it might be the ductus arteriosus. So what happens if it's a blue baby? They want to know right away if it's the atrium or if it's ductus arteriosus. Echocardiogram, they can tell really quick because they can see the flow going across. And what do? They go in with a catheter usually quickly, and they can just push the little flap if it's not defective where it didn't develop, but maybe the flap didn't close. So all they do is go in, and they push the little flap, and it adheres to the tissue, and it seals up. It's done. Finished. Great. Ductus arteriosus, a little bit more of a problem if it stays open. They can inject a drug that causes this to constrict, but if the mother was taking medications while she was pregnant, sometimes these drugs don't work well. Indomethacin, an anti-inflammatory drug, can keep this thing patent if, when you're pregnant and you're taking that, like you get joint pains or swelling, and you don't feel good, so you take some medication, you take away the pain, well, that can cause problems with ductus arteriosus, which is really kind of interesting culturally. So in Chile, where did Nigel teach you? Peru, yes, there we go. Peru. So up in this area where the indigenous people live, the government actually has a process where they actually tell the people to come down to the sea level, which is the other town I forgot the name of, and to have their babies. Why? Because if the babies are born at high altitude, they keep a patient up to arteriosus. Isn't that wild? And then it causes problems later on. So that's kind of interesting to think about.
and maybe, you know, some issues too if you're living in high altitude for a long time, like in Colorado, for example, where some people might be more sensitive to it. Pretty neat to think about.
Okay, so let's look through this kind of thing. Now, this diagram, I know it's too much to read, but I just put it in the PowerPoint so you can look at it yourself. But down here, I'm going to jump over to this. When you develop as a fetus, you look like this middle figure here, pretty much. This is the diagram of your six gill arches. Really no different than a fish, because the gill arches are just like those going to the gills of the fish. That's why they call them gill arches. Some people actually don't close these. In you, as an adult, you can look at those and they'll be ligaments. They'll be leftover remnants of this. They're just ligaments that are left over. So here are the ligaments. But these gill arches early on in embryonic development are very important. They are the ones that make up your carotid arteries. They're the ones that make up your aorta. And now this one that comes off to make up the aorta on the usually, which way does your aorta come off your heart? Off your left ventricle. Does it go this way or that way? It goes to your left side usually, right? And then the carotid arteries come off. But some people, actually, that doesn't happen that way. They have an aorta that goes off the right side. And it's only because that aorta, that gill arch closed and the other one stayed open. So it just matters. But majority of people have it on their left side. But there are all these abnormalities where it actually has developed on the right side instead, and they live perfectly fine lives. But it kind of would confuse somebody in the ER sometime, or, you know, if something goes wrong, so they actually image to make sure things are right. But this one, the sixth gill arch, is the ductus arteriosus. Somewhere here. Ductus arteriosus. This is the one as a fetus is patent to get blood from the pulmonary artery over to your aorta to bypass your lungs. But as in when you're born, you want that to close. So usually with your first breath of air or so, it closes. And it's usually through prostaglandins that are activated. But remember, anti-inflammatory agents do what? They inhibit prostaglandins. So then you have a problem with if you've been taking indomethacin or prostaglandin inhibitor while you've been pregnant. So, you know, this is why it's really important to get some good care while you're pregnant. So here are some diagrams for a fetal circulation. The main things, you know, you're getting oxygenation from the placenta, right? Where is the high oxygenation now in your circulatory system? Where is it the lowest usually?
If you were to take a spot in the circulatory system in you, where is it probably the lowest oxygenation? Right before it goes to get oxygen, right? Which is right before, if you had to test in different aspects, right atrium, right ventricle, pulmonary artery, that would be the answer that you'd want to choose, okay? So, are all arteries highly oxygenated? No, right? Are all veins mostly with low oxygen? No. What's your most highly oxygenated tissue or part of your circulatory system? Pulmonary, a vein, right? But in the fetus now, it's not getting oxygenation from the lungs, right? So on a standardized exam, or a Brent Palmer used to try to test people and confuse them on this, is in high circulation would come from where? You know, high oxygenation, right? It would be on the right side. It would be pretty high because it's coming in from the placenta and it's going to the right atrium, right ventricle, and out the body. So it's on the right side.
Okay, so kind of cool. And then you see the foraminal valve here, and you see the ductus arteriosus that's between the pulmonary artery and the aorta to bypass the lungs. So pretty cool. If you got time over the summer, I'm not going to go through it, but you know, I think it's kind of fun. There's lots of websites you can listen to heart sounds. Really quite neat. Put you to sleep, you know, things like that you might want to listen to. And the defects that are out there in the world. Okay, so this is the point about indomethacin. I just put it up there for kind of your benefit. You know, not to test you on this details, but especially for the gals or guys that have somebody that might be getting pregnant. Don't take too many medications while you're developing a little fetal thing. Okay, so kind of neat. I'm not going to test you on this, but it's really neat to think about the heart rate and how it's regulated, like we talked about. You can actually detect the development of the fetus, and people used to use this for many years, just listening to the heart rate to know the developmental stage before they had all these other echocardiogram measurements that they could do. But you could actually measure the age of the fetus in general by using this equation. I'm not going to test you on this, but this is just the idea that it does change. But look at this, 185 beats per minute, that little fetal heart. Can you imagine? Very energetic, demanding. So here's kind of the fetal heart rate as it develops, and then, you know, continues on then with parturition and all this kind of good stuff. All right. Heart diseases, just to kind of get the general idea. I'm not going to test you on these all these different aspects. But for your own benefit, there's a tremendous number of genetic abnormalities, and usually they go along with something else that's wrong. You can even think of coloboma. There's people here in the department in biology that study coloboma and development of zebrafish, for example. But usually there's some other defects as well, because once there's one developmental defect, there's usually some others that are related to it. So pretty neat. If you look at the abnormalities in the heart, some common ones that go on, this one's kind of interesting, this tetralogy of Fallot, where there's four different things that go wrong with the heart in development. This pulmonary stenosis. Stenosis means it's too small, right? Stenotic, and it's too small and not getting good blood flow out. Some other ones that are common, ventricular septal defect. That's a real big problem because the ventricle doesn't develop right in development, and then the blood isn't separated from the right and left. So you can look through this for your own kind of fun thing. It got cut off here, but usually there's like four different things wrong. The aorta doesn't come off right. The ventricle's got a problem. Mixing of blood. Lots of cardiac abnormalities. Cases here that have lots of problems. Anybody work in cardiac unit here? Pretty cool in the infant program. But, you know, the real bad cases, they actually send up to Cincinnati Children's Hospital for surgery, or maybe even to Cozar in Louisville for surgery. So some of the real bad cases they don't even deal with here. They send them off to do it. But look at some of these. Now with surgeries, you know, and corrections, they can solve things, but some of these are so bad that, you know, mortality is pretty high. And when you think about these problems, you wonder, where do they come about, right? So echocardiogram is really important. SIDS, we talked a little bit about it. Some people, there's lots of controversy of sudden infant death syndrome. Some people think it has to do with genetic abnormalities in ion channels. Others, maybe not being able to sense CO2 and pH right. But a lot of times it happens with overheating of the child. All right, so when you think about the electrical activity of the heart that we've talked about, and all the ion channels that are involved, and pacemaker potentials, and contractility, and regulation of calcium, you think about all these channels and all these proteins, and every one of these proteins can have a mutational defect. Whew, you're pretty lucky you just live, you know, the age you are. In development, you wonder, how does a pacemaker potential even come about, right? How is it that the heart even starts pacing? So there's developmental times. Developmental biology is a really good course to take here, but they don't go into all these system developments. It's kind of more global. But this is a really neat subject, development of pacemaker potentials. Guess what animals they're using to understand some of this? Fruit flies. Yes, your little Drosophila that you like to whack. They actually make genetic mutations in these to understand the pacemaker potential and how they have effects or medications on them to understand. But look at, you can see all these different ion channels and how their expression level changes during development. Pretty cool. Okay, so let's go through this. If you're ever interested in doing something, if you're not, you know, going to med school maybe or something else, and you still want to, don't want the big bills later on, and still work pretty neat. Has anybody ever shadowed a part of the sonogram people? If you ever get a chance to shadow, really neat to do this, because these people, they're trained just to do this. This is not a cardiologist. This is a trained technician that's doing this and actually getting the measurements for the cardiologist to read, right? If they don't do it right, the cardiologist has the wrong information. So their job is really important, but pretty neat, because they can measure with echocardiogram. They can measure ejection fraction. They can measure the size of the ventricle, the blood vessels and how they're working, and they can pick up these abnormalities early on and then decide if they need to go to surgery. But this is pretty cool what they can do with echocardiograms today. All right, so we've already talked about some of these aspects about radii, but one thing we want to relate to is this arteries, particularly aorta, for elasticity. So let's think about the aorta, for example.
before we get into this next step. The aorta, what happened here? We had the left ventricle contract, high pressure, right? 120 millimeters of mercury. That's a lot of pressure. Going to the aorta. So what happens in the aorta? It's distensible. Now the word distensible means like less elastic, right? So last, on one exam, we used that word distensibility. You ask what that means. Okay, so it's elastic, it's like elasticity. So distensibility of the aorta, so it can distend. So you have this pump, and you distend it. Now what's going to happen? It's going to have this elastic recoil and come back down. But the aortic valve is closed. So what does it do? It pushes blood down the aorta, right? It maintains your blood pressure. All right, so now let's change this. So let's look at the pulse pressure. Pulse pressure is the difference between systole and diastole, right? So systole and diastole. So that's the pulse pressure, and people measure that. Now, if you had elastic recoil, what would happen to your pulse pressure? So you pump it into the aorta. It takes away that peak pressure, right? Because it's elastic. And then when it kind of comes back down, it doesn't drop all the way down because the elastic recoil is maintaining the lower pressure, right? Because it's coming back down. It's like that balloon, right? Now, let's think about the other scenario. What if it was a steel pipe and you had the same pump? You pump that fluid into the steel pipe. What's going to happen to the pressure? The pump, the steel pipe's not going to distend, right? So what's going to happen to the pressure? Shoot way up. And then as the blood goes down, what's going to happen to maintain that pressure? There is none. Right, so it drops way down. So the difference of the steel pipe is your pulse pressure is much higher and lower, so you have a bigger pulse pressure difference. If you have a distensibility, then you have a shorter pulse pressure or a lower difference between the two, right? So now you relate that to what? Hardening of the arteries, which is related to arteriosclerosis, right? Building up a plaque. So now we understand why that's so bad to build up the plaque, right? Because your pulse pressure is going to be higher and you can't maintain your blood pressure. All right, so this is the idea of distensibility of the aorta, but also your veins then have this kind of, it's not so much maintaining the blood pressure, but as a reserve in your veins. It just, they hold more blood. If you're standing here or sitting here, your blood is pooling in your veins. And if you needed to exercise right now, you would mobilize that blood by contraction of your skeletal muscle, and that would mobilize it into your from your veins into your skeletal muscle capillary beds, but the arteries then as well. Okay. So mean arterial pressure, something to think about here. This equation is commonly used. I think it might even be a Kaplan type of test. So mean arterial pressure is the diastolic pressure plus 1/3 of the difference between systole and diastole. And that's important because people measure that. And you can measure systole and diastole, right, with the pressure cuff, right? Your sphygmometer. So you can put that onto your arm and you can measure systole and diastole and you can get what is their mean pressure. And if it peaks and goes down, you probably have some arthrosclerosis. People even measure clinically between your leg, your ankle, and your brachial. So it's called ankle-brachial difference, to find out if there's some problems in between these regions. So mean pressure, you know, right through here, from the equation that we just referred to, it's not just the difference between diastole and systole or the average between these two. Okay. Alrighty. I think we've talked about sympathetic fibers already and that kind of stuff. So this kind of figure is really important. So in the ventricle, we have, you know, high pressure, like 120, and drops way down to relaxes. But in the systemic circulation, that's outside the heart, we're talking about the aorta all the way down to the capillaries and venules and back to the left heart. So where's the pressure the lowest in the closed circulatory system? If we think about aorta, arterioles, venules, vena cava, you know, left atrium. A lot of times people put the wrong answer. A lot of times people put capillary beds because they think that's where the lowest pressure is. But then how would you get blood out of a capillary bed? Pressure has to go down the gradient, right? So the lowest pressure is at the end of the circulation point
when it enters back into the atrium, right? So it's back in the inferior and superior vena cava right before it enters into the things did. Okay, right before it enters back in there. All right, so that's important to remember. Okay, my thing's gone crazy. Why has this gone crazy? My PowerPoint just died for some reason. Maybe it'll come back to life here in a second. All right, next figure is. All right. Something is dying. Crap. Okay, so I've got an idea. I can get through this in just a little bit. Why don't we take a pee break, and then we'll come back and finish this up real quick, and then answer any questions you have on all exams, and I'll get this thing working. All right, pee break time.